Yo, people, Anna David with After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, a website determined to change the face and get rid of the stigma around addiction and recovery. Now, After Party is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for treatment centers across the globe. You can go there to see if your rehab stay could be free. Go to RehabReviews.com/benefits-check. What else can you do there, you may ask? You can get a Recover Girl t-shirt. Just go to rehabreviews.com/after-party/shop. Anyway, you'd know all of this if you were signed up for our newsletter. What are you doing? Go sign up, rehabreviews.com/newsletter-sign-up. Now here's the show.
Welcome to the After Party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, After Party Pod here. You know it, you downloaded it. Welcome to the show if you're new. Welcome to the show if you're not new. How do you feel about that intro that becomes before this intro? I listen to every episode before it posts, and I listen to that and I go, God damn it, that's annoying. But then I was thinking, you know, you kind of get used to it and it becomes like white noise. But if you hate it, tell me, and I'm not afraid to get rid of it. I don't know that anybody's signing up for the newsletter or checking the banner ad as a result of hearing that. I could be wrong. Please tell me. I haven't been getting as many emails lately. I know you guys are busy, and I am too, which is why this intro is going to be, this whole episode is a little bit shorter than normal. And, you know, speaking of listening to these episodes and kind of questioning them, I'm not going to go into any sort of this is what's been going on with me a lot, because there's just not that much that's notable. I'm good, which is notable, I guess, it being the holiday season and me having a touch of self-diagnosed seasonal affective disorder, but everything feels really good. So I'm just going to go right into telling you about my guest today. Her name is Vicki Abelson, and I have been hearing about her for years because she has a very, very popular literary salon where she has all sorts of people come and read. She's had Cindy Shupak from Sex and the City, who's amazing, and Jeff Garlin, and Ed Begley Jr., a whole bunch of people, and lots of people write about this salon, and she has been working on a book that is now out. So over the years, she was workshopping that book or reading sections of it, and now it is out, and you can get it. It is called Don't Jump, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, and My Fucking Mother. And it's available on Amazon. And it is a gritty yet hilarious tale of her, it's a novel, so it's not her. It's about a woman who, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and her fucking mother. So she gets into all of it, talks about starting off as a waitress in the 80s at this fabulous place, and journey takes her through being a rock promoter and a stand-up comedian and eventually a writer. And, you know, to get the rest of it, you gotta go get that book. She also writes for The Fix and Huffington Post and is a wonderful woman. So that's pretty much all. She's on the Twitter sphere. She's on the Facebook sphere. Word I just coined. Use it if you want. And go find her. This is Vicki Abelson.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, I used to call it, the Autobahn to Nowhere.
I'm very lucky, because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
So I'm starting this. And so, we're very casual around here. You can swear. You can say whatever you want.
That's wonderful.
I like to start it mid-sentence just to be casual. So you just published your book, Don't Jump.
Did.
Don't Jump. And then what's the second part of the title? Because I know it involves your fucking mother. So I'm glad I told you can swear.
Thank goodness. I'm so, yeah. being constrained and not being able to swear is a real problem for me. Well, yeah. Not really. Not out in the world. I mean, I
your mother. Do you, do you have to control it in front of the kids?
My kids grew up with me, and they're so used to me. So, and in their defense, they're both brilliant and doing incredibly well. So I didn't damage them too much yet. I mean, I'm sure they'll end up in rooms someday, but that's another story.
How old are they?
My son is 21, my daughter 17. So wow. He's graduating college and she's applying to colleges.
Right.
We're going through all of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the subtitle to my book is Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, My Fucking Mother.
And you worked on this book for a really long time because you have an insane amount of press on your site and there was press about it 5 years ago. You were working on it and you were reading it.
Well, yes, I've been reading it for 8 years. Okay. The actual work on it, I probably was writing for 2 or 3 years when I wrote the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
And then I submitted it to this very high-powered literary agent who was a friend who had asked for first read. And mm-hmm. she said, oh, either you have to name names or if you're going to write it as a novel, you have to structure it as a novel. And it wasn't. It was structured as a memoir.
Yeah.
So she suggested I hire a memoir, take a class. And I was basically like, fuck you. I just wrote The Great American Novel. What do you mean I have to do that? So it took me like a year to find an editor. And then I finally found an editor. And maybe we worked for another year on the revision. And then it kind of sat while I tried to find an agent and do all of that. And then I had a little publishing deal. And I started Women Who Write, this mm-hmm. literary salon of mine, just so I could start workshopping the book because I really wanted to turn it into a play. That was my initial goal when I started putting, I was going to say pen to paper, but I never put pen to paper because mm-hmm. I can't even read my own handwriting when I started typing.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I started reading the book. And then as I was reading it, I would find things. So I would hone and revise. So I did a lot of revising over the years, but it was really done in 2006. It was pretty much finished. But then I went in and did a series of revisions since then. But then it was a publishing deals would come and go, agent came and went, managers came and went, and then the stars just aligned and it was the right time with the mm-hmm. right people and mm-hmm. it finally happened.
That naming names thing, I went through that with my first book where I wouldn't do it. Mine was a novel. Mm-hmm. It was always written as a novel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's better. I mean, the reason I didn't want to do a memoir was mm-hmm. that I had read all the addiction memoirs and they always got really boring when the person got sober, you know? And
although dry, there are some exceptions.
I'm not a fan of that one.
Yeah, I like dry. And actually, some of my favorite are housed as novels, and they're actually memoirs that were thinly guised.
What are some of your favorites?
I'm trying to think of his name, and I'm totally spacing, but it's a really famous author who's written a series of novels. And
Jerry Stahl?
No. Oh, my God. And it's when the character gets sober in New York, the book that's my favorite of the series. And I'll think of it at some point.
The character gets sober in New York. This is going to drive me crazy.
He's on the subway, and are they detective stories? I can't even remember. Could it be
Richard Ford? No.
No.
Okay.
I'm totally blanking on it now. Yeah. But it's a fabulous. It really depicted the struggle to get sober
because
mm-hmm. he kept going out and you know all of that reality of going out. And I just loved it. Although I didn't really go in and out once I made the commitment to quit. But anyway,
So yeah, Naming Names, the book, and so then it came out officially last month.
Came out October 27th.
Uh huh.
And it's been beyond. It's like everything. I believe everything happens for a reason. I'm a fatalist, and mm-hmm. the stars had to align just like it had to be right now that this had to happen. Because mm-hmm. at any other time, I would not have gotten the response that I've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the right place in my career, in my life. I was ready for it. The right people were in my life to help facilitate it with me.
Mm-hmm.
The cover of the book is extraordinary. That would not have happened with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So just everything seemed to point it to now. And the response has been literally beyond my wildest dreams. I got another review yesterday that if I had to sit down and write the best possible review I could possibly write of my own book, it couldn't have been as good as that.
Wow.
I mean, it's just been, it's been extraordinary. It's been extraordinary.
And how long are you sober?
I quit smoking pot, which was my drug of choice, mm-hmm. which was the one that really was taking me down. I just celebrated 15 years off pot, and I have 13 and a half. Thank you. 13 and a half years sober. How about you?
I just celebrated 15.
Nice.
Yeah. When's your, well, I know you don't probably count the pot. I bet you know the date.
I do. Yeah. November 25th is my pot day.
Mine's November 19th with the same sign, the same recovery sign, if you will.
There you go. Well, no, because 19 Scorpio.
Oh, look at you.
Sagittarius.
I kind of got a vibe. I was like, she's going to know about this stuff.
I totally know
what
about
sign
this
are you?
Stuff. I'm a Scorpio. How about you?
Gemini.
Oh, my, my fucking mother's
your fucking mother, you know.
But no, my mother isn't a fucking mother. Just Andy's mother's a fucking mother. But
oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry. It's not your mother.
It's not my mother.
Protagonist. You know, when my, you know what I did? I sort of did the same thing. My first book's a novel, my story. And
what's it called?
It's called Party Girl.
Okay. I have to check this out.
Yeah, yeah. It was 2004, I think it came out. And I, you know, in all the press, you're supposed to be super coy. Like, everyone's first novel is autobiographical. And you're supposed to be like, well, you know, she's a girl, a composite of lots of girls I know. And I was like, it's me. Let me go and tell everybody. I didn't know. I didn't understand you were supposed to be really, you know, sort of shrouded.
Well, yeah, everybody knows it's me. And actually, what I say, originally the subtitle was, it was just Don't Jump. And then it was going to say, a fictionalized memoir, I swear to some of it.
Yeah.
And that was what I was originally going to do. And the fucking mother thing, the whole reason why that happened is I was sitting in a Target parking lot and the book was just called Don't Jump. And I was going to do the fictionalized memoir, I swear to some of it. And somebody had challenged me that that wasn't funny enough to express my sense of humor, my sensibility to give people. I wanted somehow people to look at the cover, to hear the name and know that there was humor in there.
Yeah,
right?
I totally get that.
And Don't Jump doesn't say that.
No.
Right? And so no matter what we were doing to the cover, we have a little bag of Cheetos on there. Nothing was really putting me out there. So somebody challenged me. So my publisher and I were on the phone. It was raining. I was sitting in my car and he said, well, what's the book about? And I go, oh, a woman's quest to find her place and purpose amidst sex, drugs, rock and roll, and celebrity. He goes, okay, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I said, well, we can't use that. Mm-hmm. That's like, oh my God, so overdone. There's a show coming on, the Dennis Leary show about to drop called that. No, no, no. He said, well, what's a fourth thing that you could take a left turn on that would just totally shock people? And I mean, without even taking a beat, I guess I took a beat. And the first thing that came out of my mouth was, am I fucking mother? And there was silence. And we just both sat there and then we both just started laughing. And he said, oh, no, you can't do that. And I said, no, I can't do that. And then I called another friend of mine who's a journalist and I said, can I do that? And he said, you have to do that. Mm-hmm. And it was really a struggle, you know, because it was really throwing my mother under the bus, even though that wasn't the intention. And it's not what the book does, mm-mm, I hope, at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she's kind of, you know, been in acceptance about it and not so much at various times.
Did she read it?
She did read it. And I got a letter that she was changing her will the next day. I don't know if it's related, but I'm saying,
really?
Seriously.
It's rough that, my parents don't read my stuff, which is so liberating.
My mother will read my Huffington Post articles and, you know, I'll get thousands of likes and all these comments. And my mother's response will be, I just wish you would have used other language because there'll be one fuck in it or there'll be a shit or something. And then
are you Jew?
Oh, so Jew.
Yeah. Don't you think it's just like the Jewish mother?
But my mother's like really hip and, you know,
mine
forward
too,
thinking.
But they still can't.
She's a Republican though.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's like a whole.
And then there's you.
And then there's me.
We were talking Hillary right before it was pressed record.
Well, I started out when I was a kid, I was in the Progressive Labor Party and SDS and, you know, I was a total maniac lefty lunatic, you know, marching on Washington when I was 13.
Wow.
Know, yeah, crazy stuff. So, yeah, our politics were never in line.
And do you have siblings?
I have a brother
who
has not said one word about my book before, during, after.
Mm-hmm.
My family has not been in big support of my career.
Mm-hmm. Ever? Even the comedy or any of it?
Oh, no. Not support for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's not where my kids are great about all that stuff. They don't want to read it.
Yeah.
I've made it really clear that there's stuff in there they probably don't want to know. So they don't really read my stuff. They don't have interest, but they're very proud. They're they're very supportive.
I will tell you, and I just remembered this. One night I was doing an event, like whatever, a month ago with the Real Recovery Film Festival, and it was very underattended. And Leonard Bichelle goes, well,
I know him, yeah.
He goes, well, that's because Vicki Abelson's book party is tonight.
Oh my God.
Isn't that like a claim to fame? You took our audience.
That's hysterical.
Was it in the Valley?
It was at the Federal, a bar in North Hollywood. And it was very well attended.
Yeah,
and it was fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fabulous.
Yeah. You know a ton of people. That's always sort of been your thing, right? Like good at. Okay, and so it started. So where are you from?
New York.
You're from the city.
You can't. I'm so excited that you had to ask me that question. You knew you were being polite.
No, but I mean, it could have been, you know, many places on the East Coast.
I'm so New York.
So, okay, and you worked at, it was Maxwell Plum. Is that the...
Oh, I didn't say that.
You didn't, but it was in other interviews.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's okay to let out,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is. Yes, I worked at Maxwell's Plum for years, but like when it was in its heyday and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, is it gone?
Long gone.
Yeah.
Long gone. In fact, every place I worked is like kind of closed like soon after I left. I wonder what that means.
Well, I've had two therapists quit on me. Like quit the profession. Retire at like 35.
I'm going to therapy when I leave here, by the way. I cannot wait. My favorite time of the week.
Yeah, this is, you know, people will say a bit therapeutic to do this first. So that's good. I had someone, there's a therapist in this building, and I had someone who did the podcast and then went in the building to therapy. So, but are you a lifelong therapist? Person?
You know, no. Well, I get, you know, I say no. I've done it sporadically, but I've done it sporadically a lot for a long time.
Yeah.
I used to use it just when I would have an issue. You know, I went first about my mother and I. That mm-hmm. started me in therapy. Then I went over a boyfriend I was trying to get away from. Then a future husband who we were trying to navigate getting married. Then when our marriage started to crumble. Mm-hmm. And as I was getting divorced, we got into couples therapy, and I just stayed with her because I don't ever want to not have her in my life. It's
same
like my
one.
Favorite time of the week. This one I've been with for about 7 years, mm-hmm. 6-7 years, and I just adore her. And she's so smart, mm-hmm. and she's just a tremendously... she's the most... wise person I know. She just knows why of mm-hmm. everything, and it's and she's always right, mm-hmm. more than anyone I've ever met. I have a really wise sponsor, mm-hmm. I can say that
word. I'm telling you, it's a safe space. I know. Yeah. I get it, you
and
know
that's a word I can use, because that could be, I could have a sponsor,
a spiritual sponsor,
yeah, a spiritual spot. It could be anything.
Food, you know.
Yeah, I have, and I do.
Life coach.
He does sponsor me in everything in life. He's also my stylist, actually.
He's also a he, interestingly.
But he's gay.
Yeah.
So that makes it safe.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 of course. And I know people, and I did sponsor a gay guy for a minute. God, he was great. Okay, moving on. You worked there. You were in your 20s when you were working at Maxwell's Plum?
I was just out of college. I was like 22.
Uh-huh.
I did theater for a year after college. So I was like 22. And I stayed for a long time because I was an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of acting. I did like 3 Saturday Night Lives where if you blinked, you know, I was gone. And but it looked like, I filmed a lot more than that, but that
yeah.
was what was ended up there. And I did a bunch of NYU student films and stuff like that. My ambition sort of went up in smoke. I was smoking a lot of dope. I was, nobody gets treated better at restaurants than waiters. And so I was a waiter and a captain. And so I worked in a really nice place. And so me and all the gay boys would go to like the best restaurants in New York and be treated like royalty.
Because they all came into your place?
It's just sort of a courtesy, a professional courtesy. It's sort of, I became a rock and roll promoter after that. Mm-hmm. And so that courtesy was any club I ever went in,
yeah.
you know, treated great, you know. And yeah, it's sort of a quid pro quo. But even if it's not, even if you're not going to each other's thing, it's just a professional respect.
Yeah, plus you tip the best.
And we tip the best.
Yeah, yeah.
We know how to treat. We know how to eat. We knew how to drink. We knew how to tip.
Yeah. I was a cocktail waitress for a month, and I was in that. And like, mm-hmm. you have all this like cash because you're always getting tipped. Back then, there was like...
The money was crazy. I used to get I got a gold watch. I got first class air tickets. I mean, Maxwell's was a very cool place.
Yeah. What? So when did you first smoke pot?
13.
Mm-hmm.
I have an older brother, and so he had it. I didn't smoke with him the first time. I just learned about it from him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and smoked with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that first high, I mean, we hear tell of it all the time, but that first high was the most amazing high I've ever had. I mean, I remember this. I laid on a couch and I put my arm up, and I must have laid like that for hours with my arm. I have no idea what my arm was doing up in the air, but it was just up in the air.
Right.
And it just felt so right.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I don't know that I chased that high forever, because I had many good highs mm-hmm. over the years. Mm-hmm. Many, many, many. I love pot and it was fun. So yeah, I started really, really young.
I don't think that's that young. 13? No.
Maybe not.
Average.
You know, I don't know. Maybe by today's standards, but back then, mm-hmm. very few kids I knew were smoking pot. Mm-hmm. I was one of the bad, you know, we were the bad girls. Nobody mm-hmm. knew what we were doing, mm-hmm. but we were doing it mm-hmm. all the time.
And then throughout those years in New York, you were just smoking pot? Were you drinking, all of that?
You know, drinking was never my drug of choice. I could never understand the calories.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like a waste to me. So.
Didn't you munch on when you were high, though?
You know, I've gained 5 pounds in a week since Thanksgiving.
Oh, so God,
like
me too.
I'd like to lose 12 pounds. I just said to my girlfriend, the only way I'm going to lose 12 pounds is cutting off my arm. But I like have to do it like this week.
No, but this week it's impossible. No, I sort of given up till the end of the year. I refuse.
I refuse to let this carry over to... this will not happen.
It's just so hard.
I'm cleaning up now. I'm determined. But I'm going to Lemonade for lunch.
I love that place.
Yeah.
You got a fun little day here, therapy, Lemonade.
I'm telling
right?
you, it's fabulous.
You got a fun life.
I do.
Is a good time with the book and
this
everything.
This is a great time. I have Sylvester, not Sylvester. I have Frank Stallone singing in my living room in 2 weeks from yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Michael O'Keefe will be reading. My life is, I had Cloris Leachman 2 weeks ago. I mean, my life is incredible. It's extraordinary. But it's also, with all of that fun stuff, as you know, comes a lot of stress. And
yeah.
A lot of bullshit and a lot of, you know, and maneuvering it sober without that cushion. Although I don't mean that, because life is easier sober.
Okay. I was just going to ask you, because I find, particularly this in this past year, how difficult it's gotten, not staying sober, but just the awareness around life challenges.
Life challenges suck. And they don't get easier. And I've had more difficult days in sobriety than I ever had when I was using.
Really?
I think so. I mean, I've had some really rough times. My divorce was rough. I've had getting the book published. There were a couple of really, really challenging months. There have been some big life challenges. But I have tools.
Mm-hmm.
I have tools. And so no matter, and I have a support network
mm-hmm.
and I use it. And the biggest thing is that I ask for help,
mm-hmm.
which is something I never did when I was using. Mm-hmm. When I was using, I got it. I would never think to do that anymore. I don't got shit. Without my people, without my path, without my recovery, I have nothing. I mean, that's everything.
What's the last thing you asked for help with? Like when you called and made an outreach call? Maybe it was on the way here.
I asked for help last night.
Uh-huh.
My manager is making a call for me today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but I have found that a lot when people don't want to do something, they just don't respond.
Yeah, like, it's like the Hollywood sort of.
Just don't respond. I don't understand this way of being. And I really find that men are more, in my experience,
it happens
far more with men. Women respond. Even if it's no is a complete sentence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are women who are exceptions to that rule, but I find men personally in business, in everything, when they don't want to answer, when they don't want to do something, they just disappear.
Delete the email.
They just don't respond, whether a call, a text, an email. And so I'm kind of sicking my manager on somebody today to see if he can get a response, because I think men to men don't do that as
mm-hmm,
much.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more intimidation factor there or something. I don't know what.
It's amazing, though, this sort of fade out as a technique. you know, the ghosting, the professional ghosting that goes on.
I so don't appreciate it. Say no is a complete sentence. You don't have to tell me why. You don't have to give me the story.
See, the thing is, I think I've acclimated it to the point. Part of me appreciates it. It's like okay, so like in dating, would you rather be told, you know what?
No.
You'd rather be told
no. I'd rather it just go away.
Exactly.
There's one place where I think it's better to just let it go away.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing. I mean, I don't respond.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Or just lie. I was just saying this.
No, I shouldn't. If somebody asks me a direct question, I do respond.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm on the dating sites, which I never was in my life.
Are you doing the online ones?
Oh,
I mean, are you doing the app ones?
Oh yeah, I have one in one. And they're horrible.
They're evil.
They're so I've got a great Huffington Post out of it though. It's called Cupid is Stupid. It's fabulous.
Okay,
but
I want to read it.
I find that I don't respond to anybody I'm not interested in because
yeah.
I think it's better to just not even start that conversation.
But you clicked. Oh yeah, on the online things.
Don't even
better.
Start the conversation. I just
yeah.
let it go. But once I'm having a conversation, and I think people sense when it's time to like just walk away. I found that that's pretty.
Sometimes they do.
Sometimes. And when they don't, I can fade away in those situations.
Yeah. I had a person who, I was just telling this story to somebody in a dating thing who like emailed me and was like, I just didn't feel a connection. And it's just sort of like, why didn't you just say you're not over your ex?
No, yes,
I mean, it was a couple of years ago and I still have that little resentment about it.
One guy I met at a bar,
yeah.
You know, because actually I started saying I would say I'm sober and they'd mm-hmm. say, okay, where do you want to go? Coffee. And I was like, I hate coffee. I went to my first week of online dating. I went to the same Starbucks like five times
with five different
guys. And it was horrible. It's like mommies are there and kids. Who wants to be in a Starbucks?
No.
Not sexy.
No.
So I said, I'd much rather go to a bar.
Me too. Yeah.
Right. So I started meeting guys at bars.
Yeah.
That sounds like so Mr. Good Bar. Not like that. But anyway, so I met this guy at a bar and he was physically, I knew before I went,
yeah.
he wasn't the right kind
yeah.
of guy. But we laughed and I thought, you know, maybe I'll get a friend out of this.
Yeah.
We had so much fun. And I get a note from him the next day, you know, I just didn't feel it. And I was like,
yeah.
What?
I know.
I mean, like, why wouldn't you want to be friends? That makes no sense to me. We had so much fun. We laughed for 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how mean. Ew.
I know. But it is true with work stuff. It's just enraging. It just triggers that powerlessness too because,
oh my God.
You know, and then it triggers, you know, I have tons of insecurity and ego stuff that I've worked on a ton. But
oh yeah. My
God, can you damage it? With things
my
like
super
that.
Won't get my landlord won't get back to me about
super.
My body.
You don't live in New York anymore.
I know. I can't even believe I said that word. I'm 60. I just turned 60.
Fantastic.
Mind blowing.
What was that like?
It was the same day as my book launch. I made it a joint party.
That's smart. Yeah, yeah,
joint.
Yeah.
See, that comes up all
yeah.
the time. That day was fantastic. I am in awareness and denial at the same time.
Yeah.
It's so not real to me.
Yeah.
It is so not who I am, how I live my life.
Yeah.
That,
how you look.
Well, thank you.
Well, obviously.
It makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
I can't even wrap my head around it. It, no sense. I mean, I look in the mirror and I live a life that to me is no different than who I was when I was 35, 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still that girl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look like that girl anymore. I have issues that are not that girl's look, but that's who I am. That's where I stayed. I think we get kind of frozen in places.
Mm-hmm.
My father kind of got frozen in the 60s. He stayed in white pants and like
mm-hmm.
medallions till the end. So I think we kind of get frozen places. And I think the 80s really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of am frozen there. But
that's a great line. The 80s did work for you, huh?
They so worked for me.
What? Because with aging, which we are all dealing with in our own ways, it's been surprising to me the birthdays that I think are going to be the traumatic ones aren't.
Well, I'm looking at you and I'm saying like 33,
and we're not talking about it. It's not all over the internet. It's on the internet, and I hate saying it out loud. I can't.
Well, but I can't relate to that at all.
But
that's crazy. That's ridiculous.
But it's interesting just, you know, and even when I talk about the last, you know, year being difficult, I think a lot of it's not coming to terms with mortality. I'm okay with that. It's mm-hmm. just coming to terms with aging, which I think is different.
You know, if as a woman, what comes along with it, that whole M thing. I was actually in Henry Jaglom's movie called The M Word, and it's that word, that M word. But that whole thing is so trippy.
Yeah.
And the process is nasty. But interestingly, getting to the other side of it.
Yeah.
It, I know it sounds like total cliche, but it's the sexiest time of my life.
Really?
Which is crazy.
What do you mean?
I am so much more in touch with my sexuality and so much more comfortable with it than I've ever been in my life. And that's saying a lot.
That's amazing to hear. Yeah. But, after your 80s.
And I mean, I've gone through long dry spells, as they were, not that kind of dry, but nothing happening.
Yeah.
I went through a long time post separation and stuff where, I wasn't dating. Things were just one disaster after another. And also, my next book is actually going to be called Sex and the Sober Girl. And I owe The Fix an article for a year already. I'm so behind. And I wanted to write it for Modern Love as well. And now it's turning into a book and maybe a television series. But I wasn't sure what my problem was, why I was having trouble connecting intimately with men. And I blamed it on my sobriety for a really long time. I thought I didn't, because I had never had sex sober.
For how long?
My whole life. I'd always been stoned.
Oh, right, before you got sober.
I'd never had sober sex, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the morning?
Not really.
Okay.
No, because there was a joint on the bed. Okay. Yeah. You know, so now, I mean, there were times.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, I was still in a haze of smoke, even if I wasn't smoking at that moment.
Yeah.
And even when I was pregnant, not smoking, I still considered myself a stoned person, just basically. But in Stone Cold Sobriety, I thought that was the reason that I wasn't feeling sexual. And no, it wasn't that I wasn't feeling sexual. It was that I couldn't be... Like, a guy would start to come near me and I would start to get all, like, in my head. I couldn't turn off my head. And I thought, I have to be stoned to turn off my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was that for a really long time. And it wasn't until I was finally with a right guy that I realized... It wasn't. Then I started blaming it on the change and menopause, and oh my God, I'm uptight about my body, and I don't want anybody to, you know, this isn't what it used to be, and this is doing this, and it wasn't until I was finally with the right guy, who isn't the right guy, but he was the right guy for this,
right,
that I realized that it had nothing to do with any of that. Mm-hmm. It was just there wasn't the right guy, because once I was with the right guy, nothing else mattered. I was prancing around naked. I was so uninhibited, and it was just, I didn't care about my body. I didn't care about that I was straight. None of it mattered. And then once that door unlocked, it was unlocked for good. Not that anything is happening.
Right.
But the potential for it's there.
Hey, next bar date.
I don't think I went on two of the worst dates of my life this week. No, oh God.
Yeah, they can be brutal.
Oh God.
I know. It's too bad the process isn't the process that married people think it is. I wish I could date. No, you know. I don't miss it.
I don't know if it's LA. I don't know what it. I think things are tougher now than they used to be. And I'm out in the road. I was going to say, because we're on our computers, I'm on my computer all day, all night. My work is on it. My social life is on. I mean, I'm Facebooking all the time for work, for play. And maybe I blame it on that. Okay. I'm out in the real world a lot for events and things. I haven't met somebody across a crowded room. It's happened to me once in the last 6 years that I've been single. It happened in real life. It doesn't happen. That stuff used to happen. That's the way it used to be, right? I don't have those experiences. I don't know if it's me, but it seems to be something that I talk to a lot of. Some women don't seem to have this problem, but for me, it doesn't happen that way.
Well, what do you think to this idea of, and this was a major struggle for me, this like surrendering our romantic life, you know, to a higher power and going, oh, okay, so that's not happening. And that's because it's not meant to be happening right now. You know, I too think everything happens for a reason and the way it's meant to and all of that. What do you think of that idea?
You know, that's where I was for a long time. Okay, this just isn't my time. And one of my closest friends in the world is a world-renowned astrologer. And she would, you know, say, okay, this could happen then, this would happen this, you know, and we kept pushing back the date. We kept pushing because it wasn't happening. And I kind of resigned myself to the fact that I realized that I needed to get my career going. I needed to get my book out. I needed to get my kids. Mm-hmm. I gave it a lot of reasons why it wasn't happening. And I do believe there are no accidents. And I do believe that that I've been single this long for a reason. I just shared the other day that because nothing's been going on in my romantic life for so long, that when I finally fall in love, it's going to be the best love ever that right. anybody's ever had because right. I've waited so long for it.
Right.
So I kind of think that that's on tap. I have hope.
Yeah.
That's on tap. That I'm being saved for being in the right place in my life, the right time, when it's, and with the right person.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, and again, this was like what I was talking about, like the sort of struggle in long-term sobriety is that, you know, third step about everything else, you know, that third step that many of us were able to do so perfectly. Not that we did it perfectly.
I don't do anything perfectly.
But that, I don't know about your desire to smoke pot if it got removed, no. You know?
Oh, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
If someone would have told me, I used to think people were lying
yeah.
when they said they had years of sobriety. I really thought they were lying. I thought it was absolutely, or they didn't like pot the way I like pot.
Yeah.
Because there was absolutely no way.
I didn't like pot the way you like pot, by the way, I hate it.
But the other potheads yeah. around me, I did not believe that they could possibly have years of sobriety and yeah. stay away from it. So the fact that the desire has been removed, I think if you eliminate anything, we can lose our desire for it. So, I mean, if I take carbs out of my diet and I really don't have them, I will stop craving them.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't held true with sex,
mm-hmm.
thank God. But mm-hmm. I know with some people, a lot of people say they, when they stop having sex, they lose their passion for it.
Mm,
I,
that's awful.
It is awful. That never happened to me, but I've heard it can happen. I hope it never happens. But where are we going?
But do you not credit that with a sort of spiritual, do you just credit it with, oh, I don't have the desire because I stopped doing it?
No, I totally credit my higher power. I believe that this path that I'm on and that I'm directed to, I think there are no mistakes and there are no accidents. When I make what seems like a mistake, when I make a bad choice, I think it's because I'm intended to, because that's the only way I'm going to learn that lesson. And mm-hmm. sometimes I have to make that same mistake, not three times. Sometimes I have to make it 30 times,
yep.
50 times, 100 times. Till I learn that lesson, it's going to take, I'm going to have to do what I have to do. So I make a lot of missteps. Mm-hmm. I do things, I don't regret them. I try never to regret them because I always know they're moving me forward.
Mm-hmm.
I could never have anticipated that my life would be where it is. A year ago, if somebody told me that I would be here today, I never would have believed them.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to always be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, in good moments, let go of those romantic ideals and trust that I'm on a journey, I'm on a path,
mm-hmm.
and it's going exactly as it's meant to go.
Mm-hmm.
So even, oh, I wish I wouldn't have said that to him. Maybe it would have, no.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it's not now.
Mm-hmm.
I do ultimately believe that. I can't believe God's plan for me is to be alone.
Right.
I don't believe that.
Right.
I choose not to believe that.
Right, right.
And I don't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's love somewhere. I'd really like him to hurry the fuck up.
I know. Nothing seems to happen on our time, you know?
No, it doesn't.
I do want to get to what the moment you got sober, how did that happen? How did that come about?
You know, for me, I got sober, I got pregnant three times.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my first, baby. I had a miscarriage, which is in the story is in the book. It's a pretty harsh story. I don't want to tell too much about it now, but, I smoked pot when I was 6 weeks pregnant and found out a month later that I was losing the baby, and it was pointed to that day when they did the sonogram. And did I kill my baby? Well, in the book I say that I did. Andy says she did, and there's a part of me that believes I did. There's another part of me that says, wait a minute, there are women that shoot heroin when they're pregnant
mm-hmm.
that do far worse
mm-hmm.
than one day smoking pot, so I don't know. But that didn't get me to stop. But each time I got pregnant, I would stop and I would be sober through pregnancy and nursing. and nursed my son for like 14 months because I knew as soon as I stopped, I was going to be smoking mm-hmm. again. And sure enough, the day I stopped nursing him, I smoked and I was off to the races. Mm-hmm. I was smoking 24/7 again. So when my daughter was very young, like less than 2 years old, the story was my father had come to visit for Thanksgiving. And at the time we had a one bedroom apartment and you had to walk past our bedroom to get to the bathroom. And mm-hmm. my husband at the time and I were smoking and it was like 2 a.m. and we had the windows open. We were in a New York apartment. We were standing on the furnace. We had our heads out the window. We had rolled up a towel under the door. We had sprayed Lysol. We had our heads out the window. We were standing on the furnace. And then I heard the toilet flush. And in the morning, my father asked about the smell, and I blamed it on my husband, like mm-hmm. any good addict. And the next year when he was coming, or maybe it was 2 years later, at some point he was coming to visit us again for Thanksgiving. And it was like right before Thanksgiving, November 25th. I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm a grown woman. I'm 45 years old. I'm standing on a fucking furnace with my head out the window, rolling up a towel, doing the Visine, doing the Lysol.
Right.
What? This is mad. And it was just, it was not a big dramatic bottom. It was just, I'd had enough. Mm-hmm. It was just time for mm-hmm. me. And I quit with self-righteous indignation. I had no program. I didn't do anything. I just couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And things, I have recovery in my life since then, but mm-hmm. I spent 9 months in hell on my
wow.
own, just self-righteously indignating that I was not going to smoke pot.
How did you stay away from it?
It was not easy because my husband was still smoking mm-hmm. and there was pot in the house and I was flushing shit, tons of shit down. I was throwing everything away I could find. I was just so angry.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very angry. And I wasn't sober because I continued to have an occasional cocktail
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't a loser like the rest of
yeah.
you people, right?
What got you so desperate that you were willing to embrace this loserdom of actual recovery?
What happened was I started going to places where people were talking about
yeah.
what was going on. And I would listen to their stories and they resonated with me. And they were all completely sober.
Mm-hmm.
And why should I do that? I realized that I was told that I couldn't be high and sober at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody challenged me and they said, well, if liquor isn't a problem for you, why don't you try not drinking it for a month?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a good answer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay. And then once I got past the first month, then it was like, okay, I can do this
mm-hmm.
one day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of one days at a time.
And how is your life different now?
Oh my God. I never said the words, I'm sorry, I don't think ever in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I never owned my shit. I lied. I cheated. I stole. I did not in any grand way, but I wore sunglasses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't look people in the eyes very much. I had a lot of shame. I did not sleep well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like myself mm-hmm. at all. Being sober and in recovery has given me back some self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Not given me back. I probably never had it.
Mm-hmm.
Has given me some self-esteem, has granted me a modicum of humility,
mm-hmm.
An appreciation of honesty and integrity and authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't consider lying, but like in the case of not telling somebody that I don't like them and I don't want to go out with them.
I don't think that's a lie. I think that's being kind.
Yeah. So if I'm not complete, part of my recovery is not keeping secrets, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're only as sick as our secrets. I take that too. I must tell everybody everything. And
mm-hmm.
I had somebody say to me at one point, you only have to tell one person. You don't tell but I tend to tell everybody.
Yeah.
I'm so forthcoming on Facebook, on the Huffington Post, in my book, you know, I'm like, blah. But what I don't tell, or if I do bend the truth a little, it's out of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do it to save myself. It never saves me
mm-hmm.
to not be forthcoming, to not tell the truth.
Are there things you've revealed that you regret revealing?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. No, I'm an open book. Mm-hmm. That was a working title for my book at one point. Mm-hmm. I have no regrets about being out there at all. In fact, somebody is constantly trying to censor me. I'm very out there. My language is as it is with you here. Mm-hmm. You know, fuck is just part of what my vernacular. It's what mm-hmm. I say. Mm-hmm. It's a great word. It says a lot quickly. Mm-hmm. I use it on Facebook. I was one of the first people to use it openly on Facebook years ago. Mm-hmm. It's in my book. Mm-hmm. It's in my Huffington Post articles. At first, they used to put asterisks mm-hmm. in my articles. They don't bother to do that with mm-hmm. me anymore. But there's a director that I worked for, and he gets on my Facebook. Just the other day, he got on there again, and he said he gave me the most unbelievable review for my book, which has fuck in the title. Mm-hmm. But he was like, Vicky, you really don't have to prove anything anymore. You don't have to use these ridiculous words and this foul. I wrote a whole article about it for the Huffington Post a few years ago called My Language, What It Says About Me and What It Doesn't. And in response to him, and he's still trying to censor me. Mm-hmm. Not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to stop me. Nobody's mm-hmm. going to stop me. Mm-hmm. Not going to happen.
Do you delete those comments when they're there?
You know, the first time he did it and somebody else who's working with me backed him up, I deleted both of their comments. I'm not so much working with me anymore.
Yeah.
And this one I let stand, and I was going to go defend it because that's the addict in me. I need to defend myself. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. And somebody else did it for me. Mm-hmm. Someone else said the reason that, please don't stop. The reason why I'm here is because of you tell, you know, mm-hmm. because of the way you tell it. So thank you.
You know, something you just said reminded me, you know, and this is something that I've so slowly begun to, you know, incorporate into my life, this idea that losing a fight is winning, that the way you're going to feel the best is, you know, because I'm someone, if somebody gets angry at me, you know, sort of irrationally, and they say self-righteous anger is the dubious luxury of normal men, you know, it's the worst when I'm right and I'm being wronged. And if I can, you know, and I don't respond by crying or whatever it is, I respond by getting angry back, which mm-hmm. is, that's what they want.
Yeah.
And then engaging, you're in it, you know, to really just sort of go, oh, okay. And just your answer is like, I'm sorry, or, you know, or whatever. Where are you on that?
Doing the right thing is so much more important than being right.
Yeah.
And that took me a really long time to learn and a lot of recovery to get to that place where I could really embrace that. Mm-hmm. And still I struggle with it because I still want to be right. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, the way to get my pants off is to tell me I'm right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quicker than it. Agree with me. Tell me I'm smart. Tell me I'm right. That's mm-hmm. the hottest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. So being wronged when I'm right, I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that. I'm going to use that. That's fabulous. Being wronged when I'm right is still really tough for me mm-hmm. and a challenge. And for me, the secret of that is a recovery tool of taking the pause.
Yeah.
It's all about
pause,
taking.
Though. It's the pause so rough.
Is so, and I'm such a reactionary. I'm a Scorpio. I'm like, and you know, wronging a Scorpio, oh my God. You know, the stinger, the whole. But for me, that pause is everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can respond to that email. I just can't hit send.
Yeah.
I can pick up the phone and call somebody. I can stamp in my feet. I can scream and yell. I just have to keep it to myself.
Yeah.
Or to somebody safe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard. You know, a good tool that somebody taught me too, when someone's sort of ranting at you and they really want you to fight with them is, you know, you may be right. It totally shuts them down.
Yes, that's
because
excellent.
They think you're going to do excellent. The opposite. Are you writing it down?
No, I'm looking for my water. No, that's excellent. I love it.
Yeah, take it. Take it and run with it. Okay, so we have to start wrapping up. So final, anything would you like to say to people out there who are struggling, who are thinking about getting sober?
You know, I never thought I could enjoy life without getting high. Sobriety did not appeal to me at all.
Yeah.
And I have to say that as a sober woman, I have laughed more, been more creative. All the things I swore I'd never be able to do if I wasn't stoned. The stuff I wrote when I was fucked up, I thought was brilliant at the time. It all sucks.
Yeah.
I've been more creative. I've been sexier. I've been funnier. I enjoy other people's humor, other people's sex. I mean, my life is so improved that it's crazy. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. And the best part is that when problems do happen, I don't have to run under the covers, which was my response before. Now I can get to the other side so much quicker, with so much more grace. With life is easier to maneuver sober. It just is. And no matter what I was telling people and justifying that being stoned was great, it wasn't great. It stopped being fun long before I stopped doing it. That self-loathing is gone. I go to bed at night and I have a clear conscience because I've done my, I don't even do a daily inventory. It's like something comes up and I fuck up. I apologize on the spot. Oh my God. How freeing is that? No chips on my shoulder. No weights of bad behavior following me around. And I misbehave all the time. Don't get me wrong. I don't live this life perfectly by a long shot. I make mistakes every day. I just apologize for them and write them, write my behavior, change my behavior. And that's the most freeing and wonderful gift of sobriety for me.
And where can people find your book?
Amazon. It's called Don't Jump, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, and My Fucking Mother. And I'm Vicki Abelson, A-B-E-L-S-O-N, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter and would love to chat. I write.
And how can people find out about your salon?
It's called Vicki Abelson's Women Who Write. And I have a website, again, VICKIABELSON.com. And Women Who Write is on there. My book's on there. I'm on there. Come find me. Contact me. Write to me. If you're trying to get sober, hey, please get in touch. I'm happy to talk at any time.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that was Vicki Abelson. This is After Party Pod. Thank you for listening. You know, you've been writing some really nice reviews. I don't know about you, the person listening to this right now, if you did, but if you didn't, go do it. If you did, God bless you. See you next time.